Good evening, everyone. It's good to be here again. I always enjoy my time hanging out with you guys here. We are blessed to have Harold also helping us out with some of the pieces for Kazakh. He's going to teach some of our curriculum, and we're pretty blessed to have him joining us with that. Excited to have him on board. So I want to tell you guys a little bit about Kazakh, but before I can tell you about Kazakh, I have to tell you a bit of why we do what we do, and I want to talk about missions in general outside of just Kazakh. Missions is tied up in a much larger story than just a trip we go on or something like that. So I want to talk first about stories and tell a few stories. First of all, a little snippet of my story. So when I was 22, which is a little longer ago than you might guess, I was really blessed. I was part of a really fun business, and I got to write code and fly an airplane, and those were pretty much the funnest things that I could think of to do. And I had more money than I needed, and I used it for a lot of hobbies that were fun, not necessarily overly valuable, but I was living my version of the dream. I had pretty much what I wanted, and I was doing the things that I enjoyed the most. And it was what I had wanted. It was my version of the dream. And I had been a Christian for about 2 years at this point, but I felt like I was missing a piece, like I was holding something back, like I hadn't fully surrendered a piece to God yet. But I wasn't quite sure what that piece was. And I kept trying to figure out what it was. And I couldn't quite put a finger on it. And that went on for, 6 months or a year of just feeling this kind of in the back of my head of, like, I'm not quite there. Like, there's something more that I haven't discovered yet. My friend gave me a book called Radical. And it's a good book. You don't all need to go read the book. But it was the tool that God used for where I was at life right then. And the book talks a lot about just what we're called to as Christians and the seriousness of our calling and the urgency of the need in the world around us. And through that, God really blew my mind and just gave me a bigger picture of what it meant to live wholeheartedly as a Christian, and drew my heart to work in Asia. At the time, that was one of the most difficult things that I could think to possibly do, because I had the dream. I had what I wanted. I was doing the things that were the most fun to me, and I loved it. And it seemed incredibly difficult to give up that to go to Asia. I want to leave that story for just a little bit, and we'll come back to it. When I did go to Asia, the first trip that I made, I spent 1 month in a Buddhist place. It was the largest Buddhist monastery in the world. And we had a month to be there. And no one spoke English, just a few people. We met a few people that spoke English. So it didn't feel like there was much that we could do. We got to prayer walk a lot. And I wasn't really sure what the value was in that, because I was pretty confident that God could hear me from the couch at home and I wouldn't need to eat the food that they had there. So let's leave that one too just for a bit, and we'll come back to it. We all have little stories every day. You guys have the story of what your Sunday afternoon was, whether you got your nap in or not. We have bigger stories of what we've been doing with our life. We have our whole life story since the day we were born. Together, we have even bigger stories. You have the story of your church here. We have the story of our Anabaptist heritage, which goes back a long ways and includes a lot of people. We have stories from the Bible. We see Adam, David, Moses, Paul, Jesus, a lot of different stories. The stories in the Bible are fascinating. So let's just step back and look at that for a second. In the Bible, we see Adam and Eve in the garden. And right from the beginning, we fall. We give up perfect relationship with God, and we fall. And right that first day, God meets them in the garden, and there's judgment, yes. But in the judgment, also a way that first day to come back to relationship with God. And we see that again as we look at the children of Israel, and they have story after story of Israel wandering off and doing their own thing, and God always calling them back, offering them another chance, pulling them back into relationship with Himself. Jesus comes to earth and makes the ultimate sacrifice. He gives up His life for us. And that's incredible. He tore down that veil so that we could have perfect relationship with Him directly. Not perfect relationship, but direct relationship with Him. But the cool piece is that's not the end of the story. We see Paul and the apostles travel all throughout the known world at that point, taking the gospel to people who hadn't heard it yet and inviting them into relationship with God. Nate Saint, Jim Elliott, Hudson Taylor, so many more people gave or spent their lives in pursuit of taking this story of relationship with God to people all around the world. And in the end of the Bible, in Revelations, we read about John catching this glimpse of heaven of someday when someone from every tribe and tongue and nations is restored to perfect relationship with God. I'm excited for that day. It's an incredible story. But do you guys see what's happening with all the stories? How similar they are? How similar the theme is in the stories? They're all about redemption, restoration of relationship with God. I would propose that they are all part of one story. That since the beginning of time, God created the world, and since that time, He's been writing this story of restoring relationship with us, with Himself, all the way through to Revelations, where we see it fulfilled, where someone from every tribe and tongue and nations is in heaven. One story. All these other stories are just like a chapter or a verse in that larger story. So everything since the beginning of time is God writing this story of bringing us back to Himself. That's an incredible story. I've been talking about this larger story for a while, so it's a familiar topic to me. But I had my mind really just blown again recently. Some of my friends and I had the opportunity to read through the Bible in 6 days and to see just at one time that whole story that God is writing in the Bible and on through to our time just blew my mind again. If you ever get the chance, you should do that. How do missions connect with this larger story, this big story that God is writing? I think we need to start with the Bible. Also, I totally forgot my first two slides. They were about story and this larger story. So let's go back to the Bible. What does the Bible say about tying this story in with missions? We have the mandate, and we've all seen this a lot of times. It's the Great Commission. So let me lend a little bit of context to this piece. So this is when we were growing up, and we used to go to town with Mom, and finally we were old enough to stay at home and play instead of getting dragged around in town. Mom left, but there was this like, okay, now make sure you behave while I'm gone and don't eat all the cookies and whatever those like important things were as she left. Well, this was Jesus leaving earth. Or think of the weight that we place on someone's last words before they die. They mean a lot to us. They're valuable. When that person gets to the end of their life and looks into eternity, like what's the most important piece that they have to share with us before they go? Well, this is Jesus' last words on earth. And what does He say? He qualifies Himself. I have been given all authority in heaven and earth. And He gives us one simple command, go and make disciples of all nations. Now, that is our order. But it's huge. To me, that seems impossible. There's like, what, 3 billion people that haven't heard the gospel yet? How do we ever even hope to share the gospel with all of those people? Or maybe we'll get it done, but in like 1,000 years. Never something that I could see finished. I've seen it as really difficult or impossible. So we can try to go about that and try to, you know, forge ahead and get this thing done. We can do that out of duty for the command. And the command is binding. We need to do it. Or we can do it out of guilt for seeing all those lost people. But if those are our motivating factors, I think we're going to burn out pretty quickly and lose the vision for what we're doing. There is something that gets me a lot excited about this command and trying to finish it. And that's the larger story that it's a part of. Because it's been the story that God's been writing since the beginning of time. Like, what else would our stories be about except the story that God is writing of restoring his people to himself? It's the subject of all of time. Let me go back to the end of my story from earlier. So I was living my version of the dream, and then God called me to go to Asia, and I thought that was the most difficult thing that I had done. 7 months later, at the end of my first a little bit longer time there, I came to the end of that term and went to go home. And the most difficult thing that I could possibly think to do was to go back to that dream that I had been living. Because in light of the story that I saw God writing and that he invited me to live in, invites all of us to live in, the dream that I've been living seems so small and so insignificant in light of this story that God was writing. So much better than the story that I was living. The good news is it doesn't stop with the command. It goes on, and we have the promise. And this is that day in Revelations where John saw a vast crowd, too great to count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. And what were they doing? They were shouting with a great roar, praises to God. I'm excited for that day. What we just got to do was, this is like some of you guys that read a book and you skip ahead to the last chapter before you get too deep into the book. We just got to skip ahead to the last chapter. And we see that we actually get it finished. There's a day in heaven when someone from every tribe and tongue and nations is there with God, restored to perfect relationship with him. Matthew 24:14 is pretty cool too. I think this is like a picture of the finish line for us. Really clear, really simple. The good news about the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole world. All the nations will hear it, and the end will come. And isn't that really the goal for us as Christians? Is to see that day when redemption comes full circle and we're all restored to perfect relationship with God. So the Great Commission is a really tall order. We know we get it finished, and we can get excited about the fact that it is God's larger story that he invites us into. Here's the part that blows my mind. We could see the Great Commission fulfilled in our generation, in our lifetime. I'm convinced of that. That's a pretty bold statement, so let me explain just a little bit. This graph is kind of old and ugly, but it represents the number of non-Christian people for each Christian person throughout history. And so back in the disciples' time, in the apostles' time, there were 360 non-Christian people for every Christian person. That's a lot of people. But you see that number get smaller throughout time, and as of today, this isn't quite up to date, but as of today, it's about 7 to 1. 7 non-Christians for every Christian person in the world today. And 7 to 1 somehow seems more doable than 3 billion people left. But it's actually even better than 7 to 1, because if there were 7 non-Christian people for each Christian person, if we would reach one person, then together we could reach 2 more people, and that would leave 3. So 3 people, if we would each reach 3 people in our lifetimes, we would not reach one person from every tribe and tongue and nation. We would reach every person left on planet Earth. So manpower is not the issue. We have enough people to go around. We have enough Christians to do the work in front of us. Who wants to take a guess for me? For every unreached people group, so say this represents an unreached people group somewhere in the world. So for every one of those, how many Christian churches do you think there are around the world? Who wants to take a guess? A 100? Solid guess. How about 1,500? 1,500 churches for every unreached people group left in the world today. So again, manpower is not the issue. There are enough churches and enough people to go around to reach the people that haven't heard the gospel yet, that haven't been brought back into relationship with God. Now, let's make this a little bit more personal, a little closer to home. Let's talk about our resources. But let's not just talk about global Christians, like I've been referencing here. Let's say this piece represents evangelical Christians. So this is people who believe in salvation through grace by faith. That's pretty close to what we believe. They may practice a little differently, but they believe very similarly to what we believe about salvation. And then that sliver, this one, represents us as Anabaptist people. And that's actually not the right size. If I made it the right size, you couldn't see it anymore because we're actually not that big a drop in the bucket of Christians around the world. I made it a little bigger so we could see it. And if this is Anabaptist, this is us. This is American Anabaptist. So this surprised me, but most of the Anabaptists in the world are actually in Africa, is the biggest chunk of Anabaptist people. That kind of surprised me. But let's bring this close to home. So American Anabaptist people. This is our people here in America. What are our resources? And I know none of you want me dipping into your pocketbook. So let's just talk about our tithe, because we all tithe 10%, right? All right, time for another guess. Who wants to guess what this sliver of people, the American Anabaptist people, how much does our tithing money add up to in 1 year? How much tithing money do American Anabaptists have in a year? Who wants to guess? I'll give you a hint, it's a big number. Anyone? That's a pretty solid guess. You are close. $2.1 billion. $2.1 billion. What do you do with that number? My brain doesn't even know what to do with $2.1 billion. And that is of tithing money every single year from our little drop in the bucket of people. We have $2.1 billion of tithing money every year. What could we do with $2.1 billion? Wycliffe says that if they had $500 million and 15 years, they could finish translation of the Bible to 99.9% of the languages in the world. Can you imagine the monumental impact that that would have on reaching people around the world, to reach them in their mother tongue with the gospel? That is with a quarter of our little drop in the bucket of people, a quarter of our tithing money in a single year. So resources are not the problem to finishing the Great Commission. We have the people and we have the resources. We could see this finished. And incredible things are happening already around the world. Every year, every day, approximately 50,000 people become Christians around the world. And every week, about 3,500 churches are planted around the world. That's incredible. China went from 50 years ago, there was about 1 million Christians. And today, there's over 100 million in 50 years. That's about the third the population of the U.S. in 50 years in one country. And they are now sending out more missionaries than we have been sending. And that's incredible. God is opening the doors for us in really incredible ways through the ways technology is changing and the way the English language is being adopted. Technology gives us travel, communication, translation efforts, like all kinds of things that we didn't have for too long yet, that we haven't had the chance to leverage before. God is opening the doors for us to finish the mission. And I believe that this is the end game of missions. And I think we should be a part of it. It's happening. Let's be a part of it. Now, unfortunately, as exciting as this piece is, and believe me, it's exciting, but I can't gloss over the fact that there are still 3 billion people that haven't heard the gospel and don't have access to it. They don't know someone who knows the gospel that can tell them. And that only 1 in 3,000 Christians is engaging unreached people who haven't already heard the story before. and less than half of 1% of that tithing money that we have goes to unreached people. A lot of it goes to good things, missions in other places, but the people who haven't heard yet, only about 1.5% goes there. Imagine what we could do if finishing the mission became the core focus of each one of our lives. If that became the thing that all of our lives were driven by, we could live an incredibly powerful story in that. Everything we have is, everything we need is at our fingertips. What will we do with it? I stumbled across this verse, John 14:12, a while back, and it broke a little bit of something in my mind that I didn't quite know what to do with. This is Jesus speaking, and he says, "I tell you the truth, anyone who believes in me will do the same works that I have done, and even greater works, because I'm going to be with the Father." And I read that, I was like, wait a minute. Jesus said we're going to do greater things than he did while he was on earth if we believe him? That's kind of crazy. And I was thinking, you know, does God still work the way that he did before? Does he still do miracles? We read all the miracles in the Bible. We hear some cool stories from people around the world today, but how many times do we get to see this firsthand? What are the ways God is working today? And I believe that God is still working the same way that he always has been whenever we give him the opportunity to do that. So I want to tell just a few stories of ways that my friends and I have seen God at work, that we've had the chance to just get front row seats to what he's been doing in the last few years. A few years ago, we had a team of 9 guys in a really spiritually dark place, and they were there. There was a group of pastors trying to get into this town, and they could not get access. Just the door was never open for them to be there. And so they sent these guys into prayer walk and just kind of opened the way and to engage in the spiritual battle with strongholds that Satan had there, and try to open the way that someday people could go there and reach these people. There was a big temple in the middle of town, and they decided, not for any, no fancy reason, no voodoo, just they decided they wanted to be like Jericho and march around the temple praying each day. They were going to be there for 7 days. They thought, this is perfect. Let's walk around the temple each day and just pray for God to tear down strongholds. And a few days into this, the police came and found them when they were hanging out one evening, said, "Hey, where's the rest of your group?" And they were like, "We're all here." And the police were like, no, we know. Where's the rest of your group?" And there was 9 of them. And the police said, "We've been hearing stories around town that there's 27 foreigners marching around the temple every day. What are you guys doing?" And they were like, "Nothing. We don't know what you're talking about." And they went on about their day, and the police left. But that evening, they were kind of doing the math. 9 guys, but there's a bunch of people that saw 27. That's 2 extra for each one of them. Like, that's pretty cool. And they were really excited to go walk around the temple the next few days. That story goes on. Ask me afterwards if you want to know the details. There's incredible things that happened after that. And actually, the door was open, and an incredible movement came into that town, and most of that place was saved in just a few years. Another time, a group of guys was walking in a really spiritually dark place, a Buddhist place, but where there had originally been just animistic spirit worship, and then Buddhism came in and didn't drive out the Buddhism, it just combined to make this like really dark form of spirit worship. And so in their religion, as they learn, as they're monks, they are taught to invite a spirit or a demon to work with them, to partner with them. And that's how they do their miraculous acts and stuff. And they have an incredible real power. They've been known to heal people, to appear in multiple places in the same day that would be impossible for them to travel to. There's all kinds of crazy things that go along with that. It's a real power that they're tapping into. They have a room where they have kind of their idols and stuff, and it's where they do their spirit work. It's where their spirit lives. So these guys are just tourists in their eyes, and they're getting a tour of the temple. One of the monks could speak English, and he was giving them a bit of a tour. They were walking through the temple. He was taking them in the different rooms and showing them around. And they get to this one door, and as they're walking along, the monk just kind of like steps in front of them and like holds them back. He's like, you guys can't go into this room. And they were like, what's in that room? And he said, oh, this is the room where my spirit lives. But the spirit that's with you guys is stronger than my spirit and will drive my spirit away if you guys go into that room. They hadn't said anything. They weren't praying out loud. But this man knew, and he felt the presence of God with them. And without them even being aware of what was going on, just their being there and bringing God's presence with them was doing battle in the spiritual world. Strongholds were being torn down. And I think that's what's so important about actually engaging in places with prayer walking and praying while we're actually working in places. And that takes me back to my story of not understanding why we were prayer walking in Tibet for a month. We had been there for a month, and they are Buddhist, so they don't believe in killing anything. So that means they're vegetarians. I'm not a vegetarian. That was a little rough. And we'd been prayer walking for a while, and I still hadn't quite caught on to why that was so important. I was pretty sure God could still hear me from the couch at home. So we left, and I still wasn't actually sure why it was so important that we had been there. But a year later, I got to go back really close to that place, and I tried to go back and visit the place that we had been. It was the largest Buddhist monastery in the world at one time. About 40,000 people live there year-round. And when they're there, they're very serious. They dedicate a minimum of, I don't remember exactly, but around 10 years of their life at a minimum, and a lot of them closer to like 27 years that they'll spend there studying Buddhism. Here's a couple of pictures of what it looked like when I was there. Sorry, the quality isn't too great. There's some big temples down at the bottom, and then this is all just little shacks that people live in. 40,000 people. It's beautiful and such a dark, like you can feel the power of darkness when you're there. We set up our tents just over the backside of this hill, kind of away from those things. And we came down this road each day past this massive prayer wheel. I don't know if you can see, but these are people right here. So this thing is huge. We thought it was fascinating. So a year later, I came back and I wanted to visit. And I got to a roadblock a few hours away from there. And the police were like, no foreigners allowed in this area. I'm like, that's weird. What's going on? So we went into town and started asking people, what's going on? What's going on out there? Why are no foreigners allowed? The Chinese government is scared of the Tibetan people and sometimes will block their area just in case they're being radical or something like that. So we wanted to know why it was, and finally found someone who could tell us what was going on. And that was a little surprising because they said the Chinese government had come in and was leveling most of the place. There's the prayer wheel we walk past each day. And here's a crane tearing down some of the buildings. I actually helped build this wall while I was there. One day there was some guys working on it beside the road, and I just stopped and helped them. We couldn't talk, but just got to hang out with them a bit. And then to see this. And at first I was like, wow, that's rude to tear someone's city apart. But on the day-long taxi ride back out of there, I had to think, did we not spend an entire month walking those streets, asking specifically for God to tear down physical and spiritual strongholds? And that blew my mind. Because I'm positive that I didn't actually fully believe when I was there that God would answer that prayer in such a real way. And it made me stop and think a lot about the power of prayer and the way that God actually loves to work through that. So, enough for the stories. There's more stories. God is working in incredible ways. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Kazakh now and how Kazakh fits into this big story. 80 years ago, there was an average. This chart shows it, but can't really see it here. But 80 years ago, there was an average of about 5 to 10 major natural disasters in a year. And for the last 20 years, That average has been between 300 and 400 major natural disasters each year. Now, I'm no scientist or prophet. I can't tell you why that's happening. I don't know if that's the end times we read about in Revelations. That's a whole other debate. But I can tell you that this creates a really big need. Over 160 million lives are impacted each year by natural disasters. And just for a little bit of context, 160 million is almost half the population of the U.S. So if you think about if every second person here and every second person all throughout America was directly impacted by a natural disaster, whether they lost a house or belongings, lost a family member or friend, half of America, and that happens each year. That's only the natural disasters. Besides that, there are right now over 40 active war zones and conflict areas around the world that affect a lot more people. People in these places are desperate and vulnerable, and Satan loves to capitalize on it. They're at the end of their rope. They don't have a lot of options. Those are the people that Kazakh wants to help. So what is Kazakh Rescue? Kazakh Rescue is a professional rescue and rapid response organization that focuses on both natural and man-made disasters. We have a training academy that combines classroom instruction with on-the-field training, really experiential learning, that trains our cadets to a really high standard and gets them certified in a variety of skill sets: ropes, diving, medical, survival, technology, security, and a whole bunch of other things. And actually gets them a degree through their training. And our deployments focus on these hard-to-reach areas and unreached people groups. These places are really difficult to get to, really expensive to get to, difficult if there's a disaster. It's hard to get there because everything is messed up with travel and communication, and other things can be difficult. Or maybe governments aren't accepting of a Christian presence there, or any of a variety of other reasons. These places are difficult to get to, and those are the people that we want to reach out to, those people that have no hope. What makes us unique? So we send spiritual warriors into places where evil is unchecked. And this piece is really important because it's in those areas where people are at the end of their rope and they're vulnerable that Satan loves to capitalize on that through the physical sense of keeping them, you know, at the end of their rope and desperate. Maybe they don't have anything. And also in a physical sense to bring fear and depression and other spiritual darkness, to really take advantage of those people at their lowest point. At that point, these people are also the most open to hearing the gospel because they're the most in need. They need hope, and they're willing to listen in a way that they might not be other times. We really believe in a holistic approach. And what I mean by that is body, soul, and spirit. So we don't want to just bring them help for their physical needs. We don't want to just come and evangelize and give them the gospel or just care for their emotional trauma in the things that they're going through. We want to target all of that: body, soul, and spirit. Our training reflects that. For our cadets who go into these places, we really push that for the cadets, that they be healthy physically. There's a lot of physical training, but also spiritually and emotionally. There's a lot of trauma in those situations, that they be healthy, and that out of that healthy place, that they're that they're ready to help people in these desperate places. And a cool side benefit is that the training we built to prepare them and equip them for the things that they'll need in the field, we didn't try to do anything extra. And we talked to our friends at Anchor Christian University and realized that the course and the curriculum that we built to equip them is actually worth college credits, and we can turn it into an accredited course that will actually get them a master's degree in 4 years, which I think is pretty crazy. That would usually take 6 or 7. Could I have a drink? So, with those pieces, that training, our goal at Kazakh is to equip a generation of leaders with the skills and experience and the credentials and whatever else they need to go wherever they want to in the world, wherever they're called to go, and to impact the world. Our vision statement is quite simply to finish the mission. That thing that I talked about before, our calling to reach the lost people all around the world. We believe it's possible, and we want to do what God has called our specific piece to in finishing the mission. Our mission statement, our kind of more boots on the ground piece, is to train and deploy specialized teams to bring leadership, humanitarian aid, and hope to war zones and high-risk areas. And our purpose statement comes from Psalm 82. And Psalm 82 says to give justice to the weak and the fatherless, maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute, rescue the weak and the needy, and deliver them from the hand of the wicked. In short, to defend, protect, and keep. So, into a little bit more of the details of Kazakh, just for reference sake, if you know any of these people, this might be interesting, but this is the director team. Dan Lapp is our chairman, and so it's Dan's job to make sure that everybody on this team is equipped and has what they need to do their job well and to empower them in the things that they're given. Robert Weaver is our logistics director. He'll be in charge of like operations when people are deployed, when the teams are deployed. Human resources is Scott Loninger. I think a lot of you here would know Scott. Public relations director is Riley Eschbach. Chief financial officer is Daniel Beachy. He has an accounting firm in Lancaster. Research and development is Sean Zimmerman. And education director, who has a massive job of building this curriculum, is David Grable. So what are the things that we look for in a cadet? These are kind of key pieces that we look for both as the cadet comes to us and the things that we push and that we want them to grow in and become more of in their time with Kazakh. Whole heart. So this means a couple of things. One, we want them to come in and put their whole heart on the table, to be fully surrendered and fully sold out for the work that they're about to do. We want all of their heart. And also that holistic piece of really being intentional about their physical training, but also their emotional and mental and spiritual health. Leadership is a really big piece of Kazakh, because on the teams, they'll be trained, each person will be trained to a kind of general level, a basic level in a big variety of skill sets. And then there'll be someone on the team that specializes in ropes and vertical rescue, someone that specializes in medical, or maybe two people, someone who specializes in technology. So depending on the situation that they get into, that person can lead the team, and everyone knows the basics of that and can follow. So they need to be ready to really quickly lead if the situation is one that they're called to lead in, or to follow well in the situations where someone else is the expert. A culture of learning, and this is really key too, because we want to make it clear that we believe that there's no arriving where we've learned it all, obviously. And we want to keep that humble culture of always being willing to learn from the people around us and always continue to grow and never just be satisfied with where we're at. And Psalm 82:3, that verse, to defend, protect, and keep. And I want to be really clear with the defend, protect, and keep, that our ethos is no blood but our own. When we go into a place like this, there's a lot of other groups that will go into natural disasters and especially the war zones, who will carry a weapon, maybe actively or maybe just in self-defense. Our core value here is no blood but our own. We will be willing to lay down our life, but not to take someone else's and not to use force. We were there to help, not to harm. So who can become a cadet? This is actually not that stringent. Christian men and women, single or married. We have a group of 10 cadets already signed up for this fall. Our first team starts in September of this year, and it's just guys for this team, but we are open to girls or married couples. If that becomes an option, 18 years of age or older, it's really a benefit to have prior international or cross-cultural experience, able to run a continuous mile, current passport, high school diploma or GED, and the ability to swim 50 feet. So it's not too serious. There'll be a lot of training that will push them way past that. But the requirements to become a cadet are not that stringent. Talk a little bit about what the training looks like. So the bulk of the training is a four-year program. The cadets commit for at least two, but it really makes a lot more sense for them to go on and to do the whole program, and that's what we hope for most of them. Year one says lead yourself. Be someone worth following. So year one is focused a lot on them, on their personal growth, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. They're pushed in a lot of ways. They spend a lot of this first year kind of in two separate things. They spend a lot of it deployed a little bit to get some experience with an existing team somewhere else so they can get some in-the-field experience. And they'll spend a lot of it in difficult training in the wilderness and in the classroom. And they'll spend about half of that year based at home, where they'll travel some to go to other trainings. The people who do our dive training, water rescue, is the same organization that trains the Coast Guard. So they'll travel there. But it's important for them to be at home because we want these connections to home to stay strong. We don't want this to be a way for people to escape from something they don't want to be in and leave. It's important for us that they stay connected to where they are, to pastors, to church, to family. And that's part of the reason why they get to spend a lot of that first year training from home. Year two is about peer leadership. So this is about leading amongst their team as they build their team chemistry and their skill sets. And they'll spend a significant portion of year two deployed in the field. They'll be training, but they'll also be deployed at the same time and learning in the field. Year three is about team leadership. And this is where year three and year four is where they start to specialize in a specific skill set that they will be the specialist in on a team. And this is also where they start to lead the teams behind them and lead those teams out. And year four is where they have a variety of other options, but they can get into the organizational leadership. And beyond this, they have options to continue to deploy, continue to choose new specializations, to go on reserve duty back at home. As long as they continue to pass the physical evaluation stuff each year, they can stay on active reserve. And they could also transition into organizational leadership inside of Kazakh. This program costs a lot of money. For the cadets, they have to come up with $20,000 in the first year and $20,000 in the second year. When they graduate from the second year, they have an associate's degree. Year three is $10,000, and year four is $5,000. Year three is a bachelor's degree. Year four varies a bit depending on which specialization they go into. If they went into medical or helicopter pilot or something, that could vary on their cost there. And they come away with a master's degree. And that's really cool, and it's a side benefit for us. It's not the focus. But this is key for another reason that I think some of you guys will be familiar with, but a lot of countries around the world, an education and a degree is a lot more important than it is here. And it will open the door to a lot of opportunities where having a degree proves your skill and your value and will make it a lot easier to get into countries that prioritize that. In an effort to keep our cadets healthy and make sure that our teams are what they need to be, each year there are spiritual, psychological, emotional, relational, and physical evaluations. And an event that everyone attends each year, and they have to go through a series of tests and stuff to prove their abilities and their currency. But there's a lot of things inside the year. There's a lot of things that all the way up to daily that they're checking in with a mentor or someone who's ahead of them to make sure that they're healthy. These guys will go into traumatic situations and really difficult places, and we want to make sure that our teams are healthy and that they're taken care of. The Kazakh Advanced Team is a really special team. It's a hand-picked group of people that will do 7 months crash course of training up front before our first team starts in September. They'll already start ahead of that, and they'll follow that with a 20-month deployment. And they are kind of the guinea pigs for us to make sure that we know how everything works, that we actually have some experience in the training and stuff, that they can give us some really valuable feedback for how the academy is working, how deployments are, and then they'll also help lead those first teams into their first deployments and stuff. Their feedback will be really important to us, and their training will begin in August. And we actually have the privilege tonight of having Ethan with us, who is on this advanced team. So I want to give Ethan just a few minutes to share with us a bit of his story and why he's on the advanced team.
Well, good evening. My name's Ethan. I'm super excited about Kazakh. I got to get involved with it on a staff level about 2 years ago. But my story takes place before that. A while back, I got the chance to live in Iraq. It was during when ISIS was on the decline. So I got to live in a town that was a war-torn town, about 5 minutes from the front lines. And I got to see all kinds of traumatic events and all kinds of cool stuff that most people don't get to see. And I'm a Mennonite boy, so I go, and it's interesting. Like, I've never been in a war zone. I don't know how to operate. And I'm very strong in the belief of no blood but your own. And so coming into a place where there's violence and there's heartache all around you, like tremendous heartache that I've never seen before, it caused me to wonder, like, what does non-resistance actually mean to me? How do I live my faith out in a violent area? And I learned a whole bunch of stuff about how to engage in that setting without the need for violence. One of the awesome things that happened was when we went into that town, originally everybody was carrying weapons. Like, we're 5 minutes from the front line, so it's understandable. But by the time we left, less than a year later, nobody carried weapons. There was a peace that came to the town through us, and we got to give audio Bibles to people, and there were people that were saved through that, and it was so incredible. So I got a serious passion for the people that are hurting in the worst way, and I'm super excited about being able to be a part of the advanced team going into these places that nobody goes to.
I'm really excited for Ethan and the advanced team to hit the field and start paving the way for our teams to go out. So I want to wrap this up. Action I would like you guys to take. So this piece, I hope that the things that I've talked about tonight have challenged you to live intentionally and to maybe to do hard things. Not Kazakh will not be for everyone. Actually, for only a handful of people will this be the right fit. But I challenge all of you to really live in a way that you do the hard things and give God the opportunities to show up in really special ways when we step outside of our comfort zone, whatever those things are that he calls you to. Become a cadet. If there's anybody here that's intrigued, we'd be excited to have you as a cadet. We believe that there was some people who were born for the challenge. Financial giving is another way. We're not here to beg for money, but this program costs a lot of money. The figures that I gave that the cadets are supposed to cover is a lot of money for them, but that actually only covers about a third of their training costs. The rest is covered by Kazakh, and then deployments are also really expensive. So if God does put it on your heart, you can find info on our website to be involved in other ways. You can find our website here, kazakhrescue.com, and our Instagram has a lot of content for Some of the things that the teams will be in, once the teams are out, there'll be pictures of what they're getting into. I just have one more thing. I guess you can grab this for me. I want to do just a little bit of an object lesson here. And this is, ironically, something that I first saw on the stage about 8 or 9 years ago, and that was actually a piece of my story and my venture to the other side of the world. But some of the things that I've talked about here are hard and require a lot of sacrifice and probably actually aren't fun. But I want to just lend a little perspective to them. So let's suppose that this rope represents our life. And it goes off around the corner. I can't quite see the end of it, somewhere over there, but don't know exactly where it's at. But there's a lot of rope here. And a chunk of it was, you know, childhood and fun memories growing up. There was a piece where I thought I was living the dream, and then God asked me to give up what I thought was a pretty huge section of it. And I was pretty worried about it. And then looking back, they were some of the best years of my life. But it all seems long. There's a lot of it, especially to us young people. But I would like to picture if this represented our life and this was eternity after, then how insignificant do those years look that I thought were such a big deal, because they're there, I can hardly show you where they're at. And all the big things that God might ask us to do today, or maybe with the rest of our life, how insignificant does it look in light of eternity, in light of the larger story and what God is writing in all of time, and the importance that piece plays? Paul gave us an incredible picture of looking for the end of this red piece. We don't know where that piece is. It could be tomorrow unexpectedly. We don't know where it's at. But Paul painted this really cool picture where he talked about all the things he'd been given, and he counted them garbage. And Paul really had everything. Paul had the best upbringing. He had the best education. He was respected by the high priest. Like, Paul was the man. And Paul said, I counted all garbage that I might gain Christ. And then he talked about his striving to make this piece count for everything it was worth. I pressed toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. He gave everything he had in this piece to make certain that it counted in the rest of this piece. And his challenge is to be willing to do those hard things, to make the sacrifices, to give God the opportunities to work through us, to show up in really cool ways, do the things that we're not big enough to do, but the things that matter in eternity. If you are in any way excited about the larger story that God is writing and the piece that he's invited you to play in it, I'd like for you to stand up. And that makes me excited. Let's pause for a word of prayer. Father, I just thank you for tonight. Father, I thank you for the large story that you're writing, this incredible story since the beginning of time of drawing us back to relationship with you, restoring what we once had with you and what we will one day have again. Father, thank you that you have called each and every one of us into that story, that you have a place for us there and a piece you want us to play. Father, it seems some days that our lives are insignificant, but thank you that you have written us into this grand story that you're writing. I just pray that you would make it clear to us the ways that you are asking us to be a part of your story, and that you would help us to hold loosely the things that we have, be willing to make the sacrifices that you call us to. You've told us that it won't be easy, but that you will be enough. I just ask for grace for each one of us to live boldly, to step out in faith, and to give you the opportunities to come through for us. Father, thanks for each one here tonight. Just pray your blessing on us as we go from here. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.